All right. So, great, Saturday. How you doing today, Karim?
I'm doing well, brother. How you doing?
Doing great. Appreciate you joining me for this Conscious RT overview webinar. What I want to do is kind of allow our folks to hear an overview of 4 to 5 key areas that they, I get a lot of questions from members and folks within our meetup group on what's going on in Baltimore City. And I understand that, and I know you in the context that you are a developer in Baltimore City. You've done a lot of great development in Baltimore City. So I felt there would be a better person to ask these 4 or 5 different topics. So let's begin by just kind of letting everyone know kind of what's your background, what's your experience, and how long you've been working as a developer and a real estate broker in Baltimore City.
Sure. So my name is Karim Harriet. I have been investing in Baltimore since the late 90s. I actually flipped my first house when I was a junior at Morgan State. And from there, I continued to flip, buy, sell, buy, hold. I was a landlord for quite a while. And then I ended up just focusing on buying and selling property. And around 2010, 2011, I ended up focusing on East Baltimore around Johns Hopkins. And I've in that time frame since the late 90s, I've developed over 100 properties in Baltimore City. And then I've also done several in Baltimore County, Harford County, and a couple down in Anne Arundel.
Okay. Now, when you say develop, define develop. For our
Sure.
listening audience, so they get more clarity on that.
Sure. So when I say develop, I mean I've purchased the properties or I've been in a group that has purchased the properties. We have fixed the properties up and generally sold them. But sometimes we did hold on to them and just kept them as rental properties to build up a cash flow.
Okay. Now, how would you define, or do you see a difference in your mind between a developer and a real estate investor? A lot of people use those interchangeably, and I see a difference, but I just kind of wanted to see if you have a broader difference in.
Sure. So for me, when I say developer versus investor, an investor is somebody who is, in my opinion, a little more sporadic with what they're doing. They're basically just chasing the dollar. They're just going after what's going to make them money. As a developer, as an investor, you may look at a property that is, say, over in Northwest Baltimore, and you may go do that property, buy it, fix it up, sell it. Then you may go do another property that's on the east side. And then you may do something downtown. And your whole mission is just to continue to flip your money, turn it over, and increase your bottom line, basically. As a developer, there's a lot more participation in the actual community. What you're taking into account is not only buying and fixing up the property, selling it or renting it, but also what is the impact going to be on the neighborhood? You're participating a lot of times with the community associations in the area. You're engaging the city to try to get services sometimes for people, or you're putting your own people into people's houses, trying to help them out, doing trash cleanup, murals, things that will help to improve the community, different programs for the kids. And you find yourself focusing on a geographic area that, in some people's case, is as large as Baltimore City. And in my own case, when I've operated as a developer, I've honed in on specific parts of town that I just was focusing on to try to improve blocks at a time, or several houses at a time, or several streets at a time. And a lot of times it's in conjunction with other parties that also have an interest in seeing that neighborhood improve.
Okay, what skills would you say that are required to be a developer?
Okay, for starters, people skills. So, as a developer, you have to engage a lot with people from all walks of life, all different socioeconomic classes, politicians, government officials, people who work in the city, people who live in the neighborhood, the schools. So, being able to interact with those different types of people and, essentially selling them on working with you, to help improve the community, your people skills are important. You know, so I would say paramount is, you know, being able to talk with people, engage them, in some cases motivate them, in some cases convince them. You're not always welcome when you come into these communities. Some people will look at developers and say, well, you're going to increase my property taxes. You know, so it's important to know, well, what programs can I suggest to them that if the community does go up in value, which is what a lot of people would want to see, how can we work with them to keep their tax base similar to what it was, you know, before the community improved? You know, so people skills are important. From a financial standpoint, you definitely need to be a numbers person or have a numbers person on your team. So I would say, I would not necessarily say that every aspect of development should be in one person. A lot of times it's helpful to have different people on your team who have different skill sets, because you may be good at watching what's going on in the field. You may be good at sourcing materials and getting them for the best price. You may be good at watching the numbers, tabulating everything up, seeking out deals, finding different contractors to work with that are reputable, evaluating them. Like, there's a lot of moving parts. Designing the properties, what colors are you going to use, what tile are you going to use, why are you doing that? And so in many cases, it helps to have a team around you, at least, you know, two or three people. I've done it alone a lot, and I've done it on teams. And I found that, in my opinion, having at least one or two partners definitely goes a long way, because you're only one person and there's only 24 hours in a day. You know, so I think being a team builder, a team member, bringing what you bring to the table, and being able to find those other assets that either you don't bring to the table or you don't have time to bring to the table, because there's a lot of moving parts to it.
Okay, absolutely. Now, you mentioned before being able to, because I know one of the biggest concerns when you talk about developing the community, particularly in Baltimore City, a lot of these neighborhoods have not had any development in years. Mm-hmm. And so the value is not there. So if now you're going to be a developer and you're going to start developing a lot of properties on that particular block, then you are going to increase the value of those properties, which at that point is going to push up the tax assessment of those properties, which may impact the current homeowners who may be low income.
Sure.
And so how, and you mentioned earlier, that kind of work in those communities to kind of how to navigate that water of being able to bring up the property values. So as a developer, you improve the community, but at the same time, not price the homeowners out because they can't afford the shift in their property taxes. Sure. Is there anything you've worked on of you've done to kind of help mediate that?
Yes. So there's two programs that, that we've used extensively. One is sort of built into home ownership, which is a homestead tax credit that, you know, almost every homeowner has as long as they filled out the paperwork. So that will cap your property taxes from increasing more than 4% per year. So, you know, let's say if your property taxes were $700 and we come in and, you know, we're buying and fixing up properties and say selling them for $200,000, in which case the taxes would be more like around $4,000 or $5,000. The homestead will protect that existing homeowner and keep them from having an increase of more than 4% a year. So at most it's going to go from 700 to 728. And then the next year may go to 760. And then next year may go up to 791, but it's not going to explode. You know, that's a manageable annual amount that, you know, $2 or $3 a month difference people can handle in exchange for essentially you're increasing their net worth. You know, you're increasing the value of their assets. So most people can stomach something like that. In some cases, there is another program that we use that caps the taxes based on their income or their household income. So there's another product that, you know, in certain situations, let's say the homestead is not available, or let's just say we just find that they're going to save more money using another product. We will help them to apply for another product that will keep their property taxes in line with their income. In many cases, they don't know about the product at all, and we're able to actually bring their taxes down from what it was even before we got there. Mm. You know, so for example, if there's a household income of say $30,000, as you said, it's a, you know, low income situation. No matter what we do in the neighborhood, no matter how high the houses go, their taxes are going to be capped off at $1,680, even if their neighbor's paying $5,000.
Yes.
And so we've used that to definitely soften the blow. And look, sometimes they were paying $2,100 anyway. And we come in, they didn't know about the program. We help them, you know, apply for it and get it approved. And they save money because we showed up, you know?
Wow. Now I see it. So a developer definitely has much more, it seems, concerned about the community, and definitely has to bring much more knowledge to the real estate model, so sure, to speak, than an investor would, obviously.
Yeah. Investor's going to be in and out when the developer is there for the long haul.
Absolutely. Now you mentioned two other things. So with that second program, is there a cap on it, like a number of years that it drops off?
No. So there's no number of years. However, there is a maximum household income at which point the credit will not apply. So that number is $60,000. So if I have a household that is making $55,000, they can have the program for the next 25 years. If they go above $60,000 in income, they're no longer considered low income for the purposes of that program, in which case now you're falling back on your homestead because that's what's left. You know, but, you know, above $60,000 is, you know, they generally will have some disposable income, and it's, you know, not as tenuous as, you know, maybe somebody who's bringing in $22,000, $24,000, $26,000 a year. Totally different situation.
Now, are they stackable? Can you combine the Homestead Act with the other program, or is it either or?
You can have both. You can have both.
Okay. That's some good information. So when we talk about the Conscious Real Estate Investors Roundtable, our goal is to do development without displacement. This is one of models we can implement without displacement.
Yes, this is exactly, that's exactly right. I'm with you there.
Now, there was four things I wanted to cover with you through this 1 hour interview, mm-hmm, and got some great information thus far. So that's, we off to a great start, but we have so many different things. I don't really want to drill down too much into one area.
Sure.
But I do want to talk about the first area that we get a lot of questions from folks, because right now Baltimore City is hot in the context that outside people from DC, New York, California, even Canada, you know, they want to come in and invest in Baltimore City, mm-hmm, you know, because of the prices are low, and everybody has been marketed by so many real estate groups as a great rental city. Hmm. So I just kind of want to get some of your thoughts on the real estate market currently in Baltimore City. I know that's a real broad question because it's, you know, Baltimore is broken up to Northeast, Northwest, Southeast, sure, Southwest, et cetera. And then it's broken up into different neighborhoods. Then,
absolutely.
Then blocks within those neighborhoods, right?
Yeah.
But what would you say overall, as far as your experience in real estate investing, is Baltimore City, is it now a great time, good time, bad time to invest in Baltimore City?
So Baltimore City has great positioning. And I think that is what has kept Baltimore at the forefront of people's minds for quite a while. I mean, since I've been in the business, it's not been a bad place to invest since I've started. Like, I've never had a problem finding good deals. I've never had a problem finding people to buy those properties or rent those properties at a number that makes it profitable. So because of that, it has, since I have been doing this, which is over 20 years now, it has been a good place to invest. Now, the thing about Baltimore, especially because, and I say positioning, the reason I say positioning is because those investors you speak of from Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey, DC, Virginia, and so on, they see the pricing in Baltimore and they see that barrier of entry as being fairly low relative to anywhere that they're probably used to, you know. So the fact that you can buy a house for sometimes $20,000-$30,000, sometimes less than that, and have a reasonable chance of turning it into a good investment, it generally doesn't exist in those places, you know. In many of those markets, you're starting off at $200,000-$300,000 for the house that needs work, whereas we finish up, you know, in the ones and twos and sometimes a little bit better. So their money goes further. They are mitigating their risk because they're not as leveraged with their portfolio when they put money in Baltimore. And they get a good return on the investment. And they can't generally do that where they are. So that's what drives Baltimore. However, you have to know where to put your money in Baltimore, because it is very easy to put money into an area that is not going to give you a good return. There are some areas, and people from out of town get this wrong a lot. There are some areas that no matter what you buy the house for, the cost of the renovation exceeds the value of the neighborhood. And so that's a losing equation. But they see a $5,000 house and they think, well, you can't go wrong buying a house for $5,000, but you definitely can. And so as long as you know where to invest, Baltimore, I don't see it running out of gas for decades, you know? It just is set up well for people to come in, buy these houses, fix them up. As long as they're in the right spots, you really have a very, very good success ratio in Baltimore.
Okay. Now that makes sense. So what do you see as areas in Baltimore City from your experience that might be more conducive for maybe buy and flip? I don't like the term flip, so I'll say buy and resale as opposed to buy and hold.
Sure. So for me, what I look for is, you know, Baltimore generally, people migrate from the inner city out to, say, the outskirts of the inner city, then into the suburbs, and then sometimes try to get as close to the county as they can get or over the line, right? That is a very normal progression in Baltimore. And so what I look for a lot is housing that is housing that is going to be affordable for somebody that is on one income, a single income household, or maybe two people who are putting their income together. And so that gives me my limitations many times. So for me, often I'm picking up something that may be 40 or 50,000, putting 40 or 50,000 into it and, you know, moving it in the, say, 135 to maybe 155 range. That's a very normal transaction for me. At times I've found them for much less and put in much more, but my general MO is I'm going to hit it right where, you know, between maybe $900 and $1,300 a month, people are going to buy almost everything that I'm selling, right? Because a lot of people can afford that. Now, when it comes to specific areas, I mean, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them that work. You know, I went to Morgan, so my backyard is really northeast. I know it like the back of my hand. So I've stuck to the Bel Air Edisons, the Hamiltons, Northwood, Idlewood, Cityside of Parkville, you know, Gardenville. A lot, I've done so much in those areas. When I went into the inner city, it was in East Baltimore around Johns Hopkins, and that was really a concerted effort. There's a lot of moving parts to it, and, you know, I still do a good amount there, but I diversify back into the suburbs as well, because you can't have all your eggs in one basket, you know. But right. Over on the west side, there's plenty of options as well, you know, over in Gwin Oak. I've done Upper Park Heights, you know, the Liberty Heights corridor. Ashburton is awesome. You know, there's Green Spring. It's just a lot. There's plenty of options all around town that people consider desirable areas, you know, and that's a relative term. But if you are coming from, you know, say Hoffman Street on the east side, and I can move you to Bel Air Edison for what you're paying in rent approximately, you're going to make that move almost 100% of the time, you know. But to other people, Bel Air Edison may not be what they are comfortable with. But there's, as long as you're in those ranges that people can afford, there's always a buyer for you, or there's always a renter for you. So I tend to focus on the areas that people either make their first move out of the inner city, or their second move out of the inner city. So people will a lot of times go from a Hoffman Street to a Bel Air Edison, and then end up in Hamilton, you know, as their final destination, mm-hmm. so to speak. So mm-hmm. I end up, you know, doing a lot of those types of transactions. I don't really delve too much into the $300,000-$400,000 type of deals. That's not really my that's not my vein, you know. But you can do very well picking up, and there's also plenty of inventory in those ranges where you can pick up something, you know, between $30,000 and $60,000 and have enough cushion and enough value on the back end to make that transaction make sense.
Okay. And that makes sense. Now, with that being said, has the, you know, Baltimore City has a lot of flux in their political strategies, such as, you know, the mayor, what recently happened to the mayor,
sure.
constantly changing the police chiefs, you know, all those things, constant reports of crime. Has that had, over the 20 years, and that's been a pretty much a consistent thing in Baltimore City,
yeah.
has those changes had any impact on your ability to conduct a real estate development business in Baltimore City?
No. And I say this very confidently. And one word you just used was consistently. So everything you just said is not new to Baltimore. So while it may keep people who are not from Baltimore out of, you know, buying into Baltimore for their own personal residence, it's not really a deterrent when you are from here. It's just, that's how it is, and you're trying to improve your situation. So you want to get you or your family further up that food chain, right? Because yeah, Baltimore has its issues, but what you find is that, you know, people are constantly trying to improve. If they can improve their situation, then they're going to try to improve their neighborhood. If they can improve their situation, they're trying to move from wherever they are to a neighborhood where some of those elements are diminished or non-existent. And that's where we find the houses, you know? So a lot of times, or all the time, when I am looking for property, I'm trying to eliminate objections by finding the right property first. Because if I can find the right property in the right location, I eliminate a lot of troubles when it comes to renting that property or selling that property. So things like crime, things like the political climate, you know, we've had issues with the water bills, we've had issues with taxes, we've had issues with trash and crime, etc. You don't see Baltimore just taking it in stride. The people who can't leave those areas, they are generally trying to improve those areas. And sometimes you will have an investor or developer who comes in and will participate with them. But those who can are trying to migrate to areas where those things are not as big of a concern. And again, that's our sweet spot is, you know, when you get out of those areas, we're the people that you come see to get a nice property in areas that have less of a concern. And now when we're doing it from a development standpoint, we're diving into those areas that do have those issues and trying to improve them along with the community. You know, so it's two sides of the coin, but on both sides of that coin, you can make a positive impact in a neighborhood or a community, and you can make money at the same time.
Absolutely. And that's what we consider to be developing or investing with a higher purpose.
Yes.
You know, as we like to say in a round table. So that brings me to another question. Now, with regards to your particular area that you've worked with, because you've done a lot of work with the city. Mm-hmm. And so now, when I met you, you were actually leading a vacancy value summit that they had back, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago by now, right?
Probably, yeah.
And Sharon Rawlings-Blake.
Yeah, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake.
Stephanie Rawlings-Blake was the mayor at that time. She created the Vacancy Value Program. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of shift into that. That's another question a lot of people have questions about. Sure. So how would you define the Vacancy Value Program, just for folks who maybe never heard of it before? And then what would you look at from a context of working with the city? What has your experience been? And then can you talk about a example of, you know, purchasing a property from the Vacancy Value Program, renovating the properties from the Vacancy Value Program, and what you sold it for. So just sure. Kind of that kind of
sure. So context. So the city has a few ways to I'd say unload its inventory. As you know, Baltimore has tens of thousands of vacant properties. The city has a process called receivership, in which they take properties from owners who are not being responsible with the property. And their goal when they take that property is to put it in the hands of a responsible investor, developer, or potential homeowner. And that is where vacancy value comes from. So the vacancy value, one of the key points about vacancy value is that when it goes through that process of being taken back from the city and then officially becoming a vacancy value property, one of the big benefits is that whoever ultimately buys that property as the homeowner, they get a $10,000 grant from the city. And that is a very big distinguishing factor from pretty much any other type of way of getting property from wholesalers or from other parts of the city that also liquidate property or from the MLS, is that, you know, if you get one of those, at the end of the day, when you go to sell it to somebody, that person is, say, going to have an easier time buying than they would have buying something else. But ultimately, you're buying a property from the city through that program that comes with that benefit. It generally does need substantial work. So it's typically not going to be something that you're just going to carpet and paint, remember, they're taking these properties from owners who have not given the property the proper attention. Sometimes that has gone on for years. Sometimes the property has significant water damage, you know, doesn't have a roof, may have a tree growing through it. Like, those things happen because these are properties that, you know, essentially the owner did not do the work that was necessary to bring that property into a viable state again. Okay. And so with that being said, if you have the ability and the capability to take properties that are in, you know, pretty severe state of disrepair, you can turn a good profit doing it, because it's not unusual to buy properties through vacant to value for $5,000, $10,000, $3,000, $15,000. Like, that happens all the time. But the biggest thing is making sure you know your numbers and making sure that the amount of money that you're going to put into the property does not exceed the value of that neighborhood. That's how you work with those types of properties. So for myself, I have purchased dozens of properties from the city that I may have picked up, say, between $5,000 and $25,000. Now, every single one of those properties needed in excess of $120,000 in renovations, and many of them needed $150,000 to, say, $180,000 in renovations. That, again, not unusual for it. But several of the properties that I purchased on Broadway, I purchased for $20,000, put $150,000 to maybe $170,000 into them, and then sold them generally between $260,000 and $290,000. That was about the range that we ended up in for the three-story properties. For the two-story properties, you may get them for $10,000. You may put $125, maybe $135 into them, and then you're selling those generally for around high 100s to low 200s. Pretty typical, you know. And so it's a larger amount of renovation than your, you know, suburban cosmetic renovation, where you may be putting $40,000 or $50,000 into it, and, you know, replacing kitchens, replacing windows, putting on a new roof, replacing the furnace, adding central air, updating or gutting the bathrooms, you know, just doing sort of the surface level. With the V to V homes, vacant to value homes, you're typically gutting those properties or some level of gutting those properties. You're not typically going to come in and just, you know, do the basic cosmetics, because they just generally need more than that. They have often been vacant for several years, you know, and as a matter of fact, in order to qualify for the program as a property, it had to be vacant for a minimum of 1 year. So, you know, that's just the floor, but it can go up to, you know, 5, 10, 20 years sometimes.
Now, when you're doing your renovation, or you choose which properties you're buying from the city, mm-hmm. does the city allow you to kind of, you already send the city a list of properties, like, I want this particular property, this address on Broadway Street, and they own it, then you begin that process to buy it from them?
Yeah, so there's two things. There is a list that they have that you can get from them that are already properties that have gone through receivership. And then, as you said, there are properties that you will see that are city-owned that may not be on that list, in which case you can go through the process of, there's an application process, and you go through the process of trying to buy that particular property. And beyond that, there's sometimes just a very dilapidated property that you can tell is in some, you know, advanced state of disrepair, that you can suggest to the city that you would like to acquire and renovate, develop it. And depending on, you know, your background and how strongly they feel you'll be able to pull that off, sometimes they will initiate receivership based on your request and try to take that back from whoever owns it. You know, so there's a few different avenues there, but yeah, you can certainly make application for the city-owned properties and they have an application process, or you can potentially get them to start the process of taking a property that they maybe didn't even have on their radar.
Now, is there a type of property you won't touch? In other words, that's too blighted, too ugly, too much work. As long as the market value is there based on the numbers, will you still move on that property? In other words, if it's we call them sunroofs, if it has a sunroof, you know, no back wall, you know, totally falling collapsed inside the property, is that a deterrent from you?
For me, no. I have run the gamut of, you know, pretty rough stuff. Now, for me, the only thing that I don't generally go after is vacant lots, which there are a number of vacant lots throughout Baltimore City, and that's just not my area of expertise. You know, I'm not a ground up builder. I know a few guys who do that, and that's all they do, and they love it, but as long as there's a foundation there, I'm interested. So I can handle the rest of it, whether it needs underpinning, whether it needs all new, you know, structural members, the whole back wall gone, the roof gone, front wall buckling, you know, need stars, need to be torn down and built back up on the front wall. You know, all of that stuff I'm comfortable with it. If that's what it takes, as long as the numbers make sense.
Now, you use a couple of terms in there that I just want to get a little more clarity for our members to understand. You said underpinning.
Sure.
So explain what that is and when would you have to kind of employ that particular strategy?
Sure. So underpinning specifically means that you are essentially taking an existing foundation and dropping it down below what the supporting walls as lower than they ever were. So this happens a lot of times when I go into a basement and say that basement is 5.5 feet tall. And I say, well, that could be an issue with selling the property sometimes, because people now, they want to use their basements. They want to do laundry. They want to have a family room, et cetera. And so what you're doing is you are building a new foundation underneath of the existing supporting structure. So you're digging that down and you're going in phases. We typically do 4 feet at a time around the perimeter. And we're basically replacing part of that foundation all the way around the perimeter of the house, which will then allow us to drop the floor, you know, a couple of feet, you know, foot and a half, just depending on a lot of things. But yeah, that's underpinning. It's basically dropping down that basement floor to a height that is more to your liking, and then making sure that the supporting walls have a new foundation underneath of them.
Okay. Now, would you say that you find that it makes it easier to sell a house if you underpin or drop down a basement, excavate the basement to give it more room, as opposed to not, and just kind of going with keeping that basement 5.5 feet?
So this is what I would say to that. Because underpinning is expensive. So when you factor in the cost, certainly the house is easier to move because it's it's more appealing to people on the back end. However, sometimes if you didn't underpin and you don't have that height, but your house is $30,000 cheaper, you know, you will attract buyers anyway. So I used to underpin every single house that needed it. I used to automatically go in and just say, we're going to underpin this. And then I saw people who were not doing that, and they were still moving their houses, you know. And what I started off with was just trying to, if I'm going to get into a house that needs a whole bunch of work, I'm going to cross off every objection during the construction process. And sometimes that's necessary and sometimes it's not. And you got to know your market, you know. And so as it turned out, you know, although they were getting less money typically than I was, if I'm spending $25,000 underpinning and they're selling it for $25,000 or sometimes $30,000 less than me, but they didn't spend all that time underpinning, that's still pretty good, you know? So I wouldn't say that you must do. I would say that you must be familiar with the market that you're working in. And if everybody's doing it, then yeah, you probably do have to do it.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned, well, let me ask this question before we leave the underpinning question. How much more time would that add to the development process? And what would you say typically is the development time frame for buying property from the city's vacancy value or receivership program and the condition they come from?
Vacancy value properties, excuse me, you have to go before Board of Estimates. And so I would tell people typically you're probably going to have a 60 to 90 day turnaround time to acquire those properties, because Board of Estimates, that I want to say they meet about every 6 weeks. It may be a little less than that, but I want to say around every 6 weeks. But, you know, so you expect that you're going to be, you know, tied up, and you can have multiple properties that you're also buying at the same time. So you don't have to just buy one at a time. You can submit for 3 or 4 or 10, you know, whatever it is that you have the capability to develop, but they're going to make you prove that you have that capability. You know, so from a time frame standpoint, I would say, you know, 60 to 90 days is pretty normal. It can go longer and it can be a little shorter.
Okay. Now, when it comes to underpinning, how much more time does that add to the total? Right.
So underpinning, you're generally going to add, I would say, around 30 days to a project, because it's a slow process. And you can probably Google in Baltimore City a few projects where they were rushing or they didn't do it properly and the building just fell down. You know, so it's very important. Underpinning is one of the more tedious parts of renovating homes in Baltimore City. And it's also one of the more watched parts of the process, meaning the city is not just going to let you underpin a house. They're going to allow you to open up 4 feet or maximum 6 feet of that foundation and build your new foundation in those 4 or 6 feet. And then they want to come check it and make sure you did it right. And then you can go into the next 4 feet, you know. Now, there's ways to speed that up, which we can talk about. But the point is, if you can imagine going 4 feet all the way around a foundation that may have a perimeter of 120 linear feet, that's going to take some time, you know. And right. So, I mean, for us, I would say 30 days. But there's people who will take 2 to 3 months to underpin a property.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned one other term before we go to our next segment. You had mentioned a term called stars, putting stars.
Sure.
What are stars, and when would you use the stars in a particular renovation project?
Sure. So when you come across properties, especially older homes, 70 to 100 year plus homes, and that's very normal in Baltimore, sometimes you find that the front wall of that property is bowing. And sometimes it's bowing to the point where you have to tear down the wall. However, sometimes it's not that bad, but it still needs to be addressed. And so stars are short for star bolts. And it's essentially a rod that goes from the front wall of the property through several of the joists on the inside. And the star itself that you see on the outside is essentially a nut that locks that rod in place. And it's essentially using the structural members inside the property to keep that front wall from moving anymore. So it basically ties that wall back to the other structural members of the property.
Okay. All right. Now, I know that may be getting a little heavier for our listening audience, but I appreciate you sharing that because I just want to make sure that folks understand that there's a lot more experience that's required when you buy these properties from the city's vacancy value program and receiverships. A lot of people ask questions, how can I buy these properties for $5,000? And really understand that some of the expertise that's required because of the condition of the properties you're going to be getting those properties in.
Yes.
That you may have to underpin them, and you need to have experience. You may have to put stars to secure the foundation, and then you have to have the mason, the contractors with the masonry experience if you're
conversations. So I want to shift into our
what are historic tax credits and just some of your experience as far as how they would, how you deploy them in your developments.
Okay. So there are two historic tax credits that I generally use. One is CHAP and the other one is MHT. Excuse me. So the CHAP historic tax credit is a tax freeze. And the way that I use it is to basically increase the segment of the population that can afford my houses. And what I mean by that is this. When I'm doing a CHAP renovation, if I buy a shell that's $30,000 or has an assessed value of $30,000, you can freeze the taxes at $30,000 essentially, even though you're renovating it and you're going to sell it for $250,000. And so let's just say at $30,000, the taxes would be $600 per year. Well, a $250,000 property in the city, the tax is going to be $5,000-$6,000 a year. And the way that I use that delta is if I have a buyer who qualifies for $250,000 and they're looking at $250,000 houses, right? Because my taxes are so much lower than the competition, the monthly payment for my house is going to be several hundred dollars less than everybody I'm competing with that doesn't have the tax credit. So it gives you a competitive advantage. But the other thing is this. When a lender is qualifying a buyer, one of the factors is the tax payment. And a part of their mortgage payment, being the taxes, is going to be a limiting factor for them. And so if the taxes are lower, they can buy more house, right?
Right.
So it allows me to sell a $250,000 house because my taxes are so much lower. I can sell that $250,000 house and the monthly payment will be the same as a house that they would have bought for $170,000. Hmm. And what that means is because I have a $250,000 house, expect that it's better than a $170,000 house. Okay. And so they won't find a house for $170,000 that has everything that my $250,000 has in it. It's not out there. Okay. And so from a competitive standpoint, if I'm giving you two more bathrooms, a finished basement, maybe a garage, you know, compared to a house that's going to have the exact same monthly payment, 99 times out of 100, if you got to make that decision, you're going to go with the one that gives you the most bang for your buck.
Right.
And I don't know about the rest of the country, but Baltimore is very payment conscious, not so much price conscious. And so when you're selling, if you can make the monthly payment similar, you get that sale for the most part, you know. And so I use it in that way when it comes to the CHAP tax freeze.
What does CHAP stand for?
CHAP stands for the Commission for Historical and Architectural Preservation.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Now the other one is the MHT credit. And that has two ways to use it, depending on if you are buying and selling homes or if you're buying and holding them for rent. If you're doing what I generally do, which is buy and sell, then the way it works is you go through the process of getting approved for the credit. You do your renovation, and that homeowner who buys it from you receives a tax credit equivalent to 20% of the cost of construction. So if I'm putting $150,000 into a property, they're generally going to get about $30,000 tax credit. And for most people, what that means is if they buy my house with that credit versus buying my competition's house without that credit, when tax time comes, whoever bought my competition's house is going to get their regular refund, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, whatever it happens to be. My people are going to get $33,000, $34,000, $35,000 refund because of the tax credit. So it's essentially like putting money back in people's pocket just because you apply for this credit. So I can then advertise and say, my property comes with a $30,000 credit. And the other people can't say this. And I will give you a case in point where this really came into play, and you can look at this on the MLS, where I had a block of properties, and my competition with a very similar house sold their properties in the upper 100s. I sold mine three or four doors down from theirs, and there's two of these, there's two people on the block who were competing. I sold mine for generally $80,000 to $90,000 more than they sold theirs for. In fact, theirs had rooftop decks. Mine didn't.
$80,000 to $90,000 more.
Yes, because people have their eye on, I'm going to get $30,000 in my pocket. That's different than, that's a draw. You know what I mean? That's a draw. And so, you know, I had the CHAP and the MHT credit, so I'm keeping their property taxes low. The other people didn't have either credit, so I'm giving them $30,000, and their payment is very similar to what that other house was. Even though they're paying me $80,000 or $90,000 more for mine, as far as the monthly payment is concerned, very similar.
Okay. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so I mean, I'm just saying that's how I use those products in my case. Now, the last piece is if you're going to buy and hold it, as an investor, if you want to, you essentially have the ability to keep that 20% for yourself. However, a homeowner can get it all in 1 year. So that's that $30,000, 20% of my construction cost, 30, 35 grand. They get it all in 1 year. As an investor, you have to spread it over 5 years. So you can only take 4% per year for 5 years. Now, you know, that's not 30 grand at one hit, but, you know, still $6,000 a year over 5 years, which if you're renting a property for $1,200 a month or $1,000 a month, you know, if you have anything that doesn't go right, if it's empty for a month or two, you know, you got that tax credit coming that's going to be the equivalent of 5 or 6 months worth of rent. You know, so it just helps it helps to make the investment make sense. And if nothing goes wrong, then you just got an extra $6,000 every year for the next 5 years. And that's fine too, you know. Okay. But it just helps make the investment work.
Now, with that being said, that's area specific, right, to implement those tax credits?
Yes, it is area specific. However, Baltimore City has more, it has to be in a historic district, and Baltimore City has more historic districts than the rest of the state of Maryland combined. So there's plenty of areas that you can do it in. You're not going to be limited to like two or three areas. There's, I don't know the exact number, but there's a lot of historic districts in Baltimore City.
Now, I know we can't get into it in this webinar because we pretty much have reached the hour, but is there a map that we can get into in another webinar that kind of actually outlines what neighborhoods are historic?
Yes, it is. Yeah, there's a map that we can pull up, and you can see exactly which neighborhoods have that historic designation.
Now, are there any cons to doing a historic tax credit with the freeze example?
Yes. Yes, there are.
From a homeowner standpoint.
Not from a homeowner standpoint. From a developer standpoint, it takes some time, and you're going to have to do a little more, sometimes a lot more, but usually a little more to the property than you would have done if you were not doing a historic credit. So, you know, it may cost you a little bit more money, but your houses move more quickly and typically they sell for more money. So it, to me, it has always made sense, even if it's sometimes been a headache getting the project started, because there's a lead time to these credits, and getting the project closed because there's a part of, on the back end that you have to do. But as long as you set the proper expectation with the homeowners or the home buyers, you know, it can be a very smooth process. You just have to know that you need to say to them, hey, in the beginning, we're not going to be able to start the project for X amount of weeks. And in the end, it's going to be this much time before you can settle. You know, that way they don't have a situation where they cancel their lease and now they need to get into the property and you can't do it. And if you can't tell, I'm speaking from experience here. So you just gotta set the proper expectations and everything else goes very smoothly.
Now, the other question would be, from a homeowner standpoint with historic tax credit, would there be, that's not lifetime, right? That's a 10-year, that's a freeze tax credit. Is that a 10-year freeze? Mm-hmm. And does it go up incrementally each year, or it's just one freeze locks it for the whole time frame, then a balloon payment?
Okay, so this is the real answer to that, is it is a 10-year freeze. The only time it can go up is when they come out and assess properties every 3 years, which is across the state. Every 3 years they do reassess property. Every single property in the state every single property in the state of Maryland gets reassessed once every 3 years. So this is probably going to get a little deeper than we might want, but I'm just going to give you some numbers. If I have a, let's use that $30,000 tax freeze, and I sold it for $250,000. So that entire $220,000 in improvement from the tax basis, I'm not paying on that for 10 years, period. Zero. Okay. But if the state comes out and assesses the property 3 years later and they say it's now worth 260 or 265, the difference between the 250 and the 265, that $15,000 in assessed value, that is going to increase my taxes by that amount. So, you know, a $15,000 increase on the assessment would generally increase your property taxes, you know, by anywhere from about $200 a year. However, don't forget your homestead credit. So if you've applied for your homestead credit, they're not going to be able to do that to you. So you will be able to offset that by saying, well, no, I'm capped at a maximum of 4% per year. So you can't take it from, you know, me paying $600 a month to me paying per year, from $600 a year to paying $900 a year. My homestead is going to kick in and keep my property taxes from going out of whack. So, you know, using all those things in conjunction will keep you in a safe place.
So, in essence, educating that home buyer and make sure they understand and guide them through that process is something that you do as a developer to make sure that they can take advantage of.
That is definitely one of the things that a developer would do that an investor probably won't.
Okay. Well, listen, we've reached the top of the hour, and definitely you've given us a lot of great information. You covered all the areas that we wanted to cover in this particular webinar. And, you know, I would like to get with you and do a series of webinars, because I know each one of those topic areas delve down much deeper in each one. This was really just intended to be an overview to kind of let folks know that there is some good information out there. But now, like, getting into exactly how to do a renovation, how to run your numbers, how to go about applying for a tax credit, how to go about applying for buying a property for vacancy value program, et cetera. We'll do those going in the future.
Oh, it'll be my pleasure, man. I love what you're doing. I love the round table. And whatever I can do to help, I'm definitely with you on it.
Okay. All right. And so again, Kareem, I appreciate that. And I'm gonna ask you just to hold on for a few more seconds, but I wanted to let in this recording and let our folks know that, again, if you're going to invest in Baltimore City, we definitely recommend you invest with a higher purpose. And a higher purpose is to make sure that everybody in the community benefits from development and not just you. So until our next webinar, we ask everybody stay out there and be more conscious. Amen.